Well, we just had a blurb in our little computer here. Okay, this is Joe Cristiano. You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620 or email us anytime at comments@libertytalkradio.com. If you're listening to a rebroadcast, you may also phone in your comments to area code 918-919-0101. I encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, mytwocentsonline.com. That's mytwocentsonline.com, and that two is a numeric two. In his weekly newsletter, Andy discusses economic issues and how they affect you. You can also listen to Andy's commentary on contraryinvestorscafe.com. And folks, these times are so tumultuous. They're so difficult. We really need to understand what is happening in our economy. People say, well, they compare it to the 1970s and the 1980s and the recessions and all that. It's not the same, folks. We don't have a problem with demand right now. We have a financial structure that's falling apart, and that's quite dangerous. Try to understand where we are to protect yourself. Lastly, I would like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. Well, good evening, everyone. This evening, we're going to have one of our listeners who I think is very astute and knowledgeable about libertarian issues, about freedom, and I invited him to call in because he's called in before and we've had some excellent conversations, and he'll be calling in a few minutes, probably in about 5 minutes or so. Before we do so, I would like to just have a couple of talking points before he calls in. First, I read an article, Socialism's Fatal Conceit. And this is by Ralph Ryland. It's an article republished by the Future of Freedom Foundation. And he says, the appeal of socialism, wrote F.A. Hayek, depends on the instinctual appeal of promised consequences. Just think of that. Depends on the instinctual appeal of promised consequences. When do we hear that? We hear that whenever we elect a new president, we get all these promises and all this stuff. And usually it's government doing things, which means we become more socialistic, isn't it? And he says, the problem, argued Hayek, is that socialism cannot possibly do what it promises. And what do we have now? We have a president who is promising us the world, trillions of dollars of the world, basically, and yet many people don't believe that he can really deliver what he's promising. He goes on to say, socialism fails unavoidably because it is based on the flawed concept of the fatal conceit. He says, this notion appears eminently sensible at first glance, but it proves to overlook the fact that the totality of resources that one could employ in such a plan is simply not knowable to anyone and therefore can hardly be centrally controlled. And we're talking about anything where the government centrally controls. And I bring this up because today we don't have socialists, you know, we don't have communists, we don't have fascists or anything like that, but we have progressives. Now, progressives are really, really very, very nice people. They are. Most of my friends are progressive. They're very nice people, but they are very much misled, misinformed, uninformed, in that they think if we only had these programs to control these bad corporations that is a cause of all of our problems, then everything would be fine. All we need is the right regulation. And as I said last Thursday morning when I was talking about the right balance, you know, where we have the right balance of government regulation, you know, and free enterprise. No, you don't have free enterprise when you have government regulation. Free enterprise goes out the window. So understand that. I just wanted to make that point. I have a second talking point I'd like to squeeze in. And that's the one of state sovereignty. You know, we have the states now writing letters to the federal government saying, you know, get out of our face. Oklahoma is one of them. I am so proud of them. You have no idea. I'm incredibly proud. And what sovereignty means is it's a supreme power, especially over a body politic. It's freedom from external control. Now, this is from the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, freedom from external control. It's autonomy. And what the states are saying is that the way the United States was designed, in its structured, was that we, the states, were sovereign. Not the federal government, but the states were sovereign. You know, and the federal government was just used as sort of a holding tank to keep this whole thing together so we could communicate to one another. And what happened is, and the founding fathers were very concerned that all of a sudden the federal government would start taking more and more power away from the people and the states themselves, the sovereign states. And then they would be the supreme ruler and the states would just have to just meld in and we just have states because we have different governors. I mean, that's it. But there really be no difference between the states because it's the federal government trumps all. And in fact, we see that when federal regulation trumps states' rights. And that's wrong. And I think we need to keep in mind that the states are sovereign, not the federal government. Right? Lastly, I went to a meeting last week. And a fellow handed me a brochure called Counter Economics, What It Is, How It Works. And it was kind of a kooky situation, you know. I mean, the brochure is kind of a kooky situation. I said, oh, yeah, what the heck is this? And on the back it says, Movements of the Libertarian Left. I read this thing and I said, well, I'm going to read this thing. I said, you know, and just probably throw it away. And I have to admit that I agreed with absolutely everything that was written. And it says here, counter-economy. The counter-economy is the sum of all non-aggressive human action which is forbidden by the state. Listen to this. It's the sum of all non-aggressive human action which is forbidden by the state. The counter-economy includes the free market, the black market, the underground economy, all acts of civil and social disobedience, all acts of forbidden association, sexual, racial, cross-religious, and anything else the state at any place or time chooses to prohibit, control, regulate, tax, or tariff. And in that fantasizing, you know, when you read that, you really have to read that a few times and think it through. Because at first they say, oh, anarchy, you know, this is all these people hate the state. But think about it. The state should have absolutely no control over what we do. We're a free nation of people, and we are the governors of the people of the state. And it says, and I'm going to read this thing, and it says, well, to some extent, all of us are counter-economic. It is impossible to obey all government laws and edicts. Many are contradictory, and be alive. It is also forbidden to die without the state permission. It says, those who believe that counter-economic practice is moral, that is, that the state has no right to prohibit or interfere with non-coercive acts of any kind, are called libertarians. Now, unfortunately, the only thing I disagreed with this brochure is they call themselves a libertarian left. I dislike the term. I dislike the centrist term. I dislike libertarian right and libertarian left. Libertarians are libertarians. Everything he says in here is libertarian. Not libertarian left and not libertarian right. And if there's a libertarian right, that means libertarian light. Libertarian right may be libertarian light. Then we have a problem. Then we have a person who says, well, we know we need this balance in reality. Ba-bing, ba-da-bang, ba-da-boom, ba-da-bing. And you know, and that's all garbage. If, in fact, you're a libertarian, you're a libertarian. We have the right, you know, to pursue our pursuit of happiness under our Constitution, and we are free people. What part of that don't you understand? Part of that anyone doesn't understand. Anyway, and this is just an eye-opener. He said, you know, anything that people do that appears to be, you know, controlled by the state, but it's not harming anyone, but the state wants to control or tax. That's the counter-economy. And we have our caller on the line. Is this Tony?
Yes.
Hi, Tony. Okay, you know, Tony, I didn't even give you a proper introduction yet. So why don't I just went on, start going on a rampage. Why don't you give us a little introduction about yourself? I just tell the audience that we were going to have a caller and we're going to talk a little bit, you know. So why don't you start off by giving us a little introduction?
Well, I'm from Ohio. Have lived here most of my life. I briefly lived in the Chicago area for a time. Currently I live in a small town in southern Ohio. And being originally from Cleveland, Ohio, a bigger city anyway, it's a bit of a change of pace for me, but I'm enjoying it quite a bit. And as far as politically, my background is I'm pretty paleo-conservative as foreign policy goes, and most of the way on economics, according to Robert Taft and his precedent for conservatism, pretty liberal in a loose sense of the word. I don't mean in fiscal terms, in social policies, but I find most libertarians are, so we probably get along on that mostly.
Okay, now when you say paleoconservative, what do you mean by that?
Paleoconservatism, it refers to one of the original brands of conservatism. The Republican Party originally, not originally, going back to the Civil War, but going back to the early 1920s and 30s, had quite an eruption within it. Taft, as you'll remember, was president, and he was involved in an election against a former Republican president by the name of Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt ran and did not win the presidency under what we called at the time the Progressive Party, which was a right-leaning, not left-leaning, Progressive Party, which gave us referendum, petition, election of senators as opposed to appointment, and so on and so forth. But he did set a precedent that shook up the party and kind of split it. Because of this, Taft finished third. It's the only time in history that an incumbent president has finished less than second in an election. And it also elected Woodrow Wilson, which was the first time in 48 years of our country's history that a Democrat had been elected president. You'll remember that Johnson wasn't elected. He actually came in office after Lincoln was assassinated.
Right.
So you can see this was a huge shakeup in the political landscape. And the split was between libertarianism and what is more commonly known as republicanism today, unfortunately. So that's what paleoconservatism is, the more libertarian-leaning side of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I guess Harding forward is when we start really going towards the, the what's called a social progressive era, which we have today. Was that the real start of it all with Harding and then Roosevelt and down the line with all the social programs and big government?
I would say yes, to a certain extent. The biggest difference between the two types of Republican was the foreign policy, and that, of course, was Mr. Conservative Robert Taft, the great Robert Taft and the Taft family here in Ohio, which I tout quite a bit, don't mind me. and he believed in non-interventionism, and I think there's a great book out there that I think people should really, I don't make any money or anything like that. I don't know the author, but I've seen him on C-SPAN. And he has a great book for people that want to understand what non-intervention foreign policy advocates. And it's called Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. The author is Stephen Kinzer. What it does is it goes through our foreign policy and looks at all the unintended consequences that non-interventionism predicts will happen, of course, and how they have affected our foreign policy. And it goes from the forcible taking of Hawaii at some point all the way up through the installing of the Shah, the reinstalling of the Shah in Iran, and, of course, into the Iraq War. So I think that explains it a lot, and it's a good book.
Okay, let me take this opportunity, since it's a quarter after the hour. Well, this is Liberty Talk Radio. My name is Joe Cristiano. I'm your host. And Tony, may I give your last name or just call you Tony the Brain?
You can call me Tony Palmentero. That's my name.
Oh, Tony Palmentero. Oh, no, Palmentero, right?
Palmentero. It's a Sicilian name.
Okay, Sicilian name. My father was Nalbedan. Okay. And you go by Tony the Brain, don't you, on your email?
Yeah, dude, that's
okay.
My email address.
We'll call you Tony the Brain on this program, okay, because you're so damn smart, okay? And please, and call in. Our number is 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Please do call in with your questions, your comments, especially your criticism. We'll get something going here, get our blood rolling, okay? Okay, very good. Well, Tony, you said that, are you a a true libertarian? Are you a quasi-libertarian? And where do you part company with the libertarian philosophy?
I don't want to say I part company with it much of anywhere, but at the same time, it depends on what kind of libertarian to describe. I would call myself a libertarian with a little L, not so much as a part of the party, not to say that I'm objecting to the party, but I vote for the candidate that is in best self-defense for me, and sometimes it's the libertarian and sometimes it isn't. I believe in the libertarian cause for the most part. I don't think, I really don't part with it. I don't want to say I part with it. I would say that I don't consider myself a pure libertarian, though, because I look at the philosophy as being older than the idea of libertarianism.
Correct.
And I've self-described myself, without sounding crazy, as an anarchist with a small a, but in the sense that I'm pretty individualist, as in Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson's image, not the kind of anarchist that throws a bomb.
Right, no, I understand that, right. I'm sorry, I think I stepped over your words, Tony. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought you disappeared for a moment. Okay. Well, therein lies a problem, because when you talk about anarchy, the first thing people think about is, going out in the street and killing everyone, just destroying the world and all this other stuff. But anarchy has a lot of positive attributes to it, but you can't discuss it because it's such a hot word. It triggers all sorts of images and stories in people's minds. There's no conversation whatsoever, so we have to avoid that word and talk more about the rights of people to do what they please to do, provided it doesn't interfere with anyone else. Just like I was talking about this brochure I received on counter-economics, where basically it's the sum of all non-aggressive human action, which is forbidden by the state. That means everything that we do, basically, we should be able to do, provided that it is not, it doesn't interfere with the rights and privileges of other people. And we all seem to do that to a certain extent, whether we like to know that or not. In your email to me, you said that you would like to talk a little bit about tax reform, the origins and history of non-Platonic philosophy, economics, and current events. Which one do you want to take first?
Well, I guess you just kind of set up a conversation pretty well for the history of it, if you want to go into that real quick.
Surely.
And maybe that'll set up kind of my ideas on economics. Well, I would start, I guess, by saying that previous to governments in this world, there was an organization of people. We organized ourselves both economically and socially along tribal lines, and even smaller than that, you can imagine under family lines.
Right.
Because of this, there was an existence of organization that didn't have a name, but was pretty well known to every people on the planet.
Right.
That is what essentially anarchy can be defined as in a loose term, because you can't get anarchists to agree on a real definition.
That's correct.
But that's how I see it. I see it as the original economy, the original way that people formed themselves. Now, there are people that are farther out there than I am. I'm more of a pragmatist, that are primitivists and believe that we should go back to that. I don't see that that's possible, so I don't advocate that.
Right.
But to give a brief history of it, I would go with a few quotes and a few people's names that were pretty important. First of all, there was, in the 4th century B.C., a simultaneous, seemingly, and when I say simultaneous, I mean over a span of about 100 years, the same century, in both Eastern and Western culture and philosophy that started to pop up as this anti-government way of thinking. That's the word I use is anti or non-Platonic, as in Plato and his utopian state. That's the great philosophy that we have followed for so long. So in the 4th century in Eastern philosophy, there was a, I'm going to mispronounce names, please excuse me if anybody knows the correct pronunciations. There was a guy named Luozi and Zhuangzi, and they preached non-action, which is not, can be equated to non-violence, and they had quotes in some ancient texts, and I'll give you one of the quotes just quickly. And his quote was, "There has been such a thing as letting mankind alone. There has never been such a thing as governing mankind with success." So this in Eastern philosophy pops up, and then in Western philosophy, the same thing begins at almost the same time. Socrates, in Western philosophy, was, you know, basically spreading his message on what he thought, both economically and socially in Greece, and they deemed him, the government deemed him, a heretic, and therefore a death sentence was put on him. And he ran for some time, but decided in the end to turn himself in and to face the punishment to disprove the illegitimate authority of the state. So he drinks the hemlock poison, walks till his limbs become heavy, and falls dead. Now, from this, somehow, Plato got the idea that we should have a utopian state. But there was a guy that we don't talk about much in our colleges or in our schools. And he started two schools, kind of inadvertently through his ideas, of Western philosophy that we don't get to see. And Stoicism and Cynicism are the names of those. And his name, I'm going to butcher it, was Antisthenes. Okay, I'm really messing that up, but it's as close as I can get. And he had followers that were contemporaries of all the great Western philosophers that we have all heard of. For instance, Plato's contemporary was him. And Aristotle, Plato's student, his contemporary was a man by the name of Diogenes of Sinope. And this goes on down the list all the way through history, and you can come up to the time of for Christians that might be listening in, because I have no problem relating this to that, that Cynic lifestyle was very much like the lifestyle of Jesus, and understand that this was going on 400 years before he was born. There was a town within walking distance of Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, that was a cynical center at the time in that part of the world. And there's no doubt that Jesus probably was exposed to cynical beliefs and the fact that nonviolence and non-aggression and you know, this whole idea that the rich passing through the eye of the needle,
right.
And, you know, not to butcher the rich or anything like that, but
right.
You know, the ideas that Jesus put forth are very much cynical. So that relates in a strong way too, and I don't have a problem with Christian people coming into the cause of anti-government, because it makes a lot of sense.
I get incredibly frustrated, because when you read of the from the thinkers and going back thousands of years to the current date, you know, from the people from the Van Mises Institute and F.A. Hayek and Milton Friedman and then you can go back and you can name the millions, or not millions, but probably tens of thousands of people. And they, if you look at it, they're all preaching basically the same philosophy. I mean, they may use different words, they may use come from a different perspective, but they're all saying the same thing. Why do we always go wrong? Why do we always wind up electing people who promise what they cannot deliver, and in doing so, restrict us from the very philosophy that we all wish we had, and we all wish that we could truly embrace? And I find that incredibly frustrating. And I think this is one reason why I have this radio program, because I can spout that all the time and get it off my chest.
Well, I appreciate you having the program, too, because now
you're
letting me spout, and I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure, Tony. But why do we do that? Why can't we appreciate the value of human ingenuity, human innovation, human productivity, human kindness. I mean, all these things, I mean, that we have available to us. Why do we need to... I'm losing my words right now, because I'm not feeling well tonight, so I'm not on my usual whatever, you know. And why do we abdicate all this stuff? I don't understand why we cannot appreciate. And when you speak of them, people become almost frightened. It's almost like, well, that doesn't apply to me, you know. And they look to somebody else to do this for them.
I think the biggest reason that we look to other people to do things to a great degree is because we've become dependent. The philosophers that I was mentioning, they talked about things in a lot of ways metaphorically in relating to a dog, like your common household dog, your pet.
Right.
Because they believed the dog had great virtue, but the virtue could be taken advantage of. In other words, the dog could be a hunting partner. It can protect you and wake you in your sleep before you are attacked. But at the same time, if you over-spoil a dog, the dog will become domesticated fully and will become completely dependent upon its master.
Right.
And although it gives complete loyalty, the master is actually preying upon the better virtues of the dog in order to take the dog's liberties away from it for his own pleasure.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's an excellent point. I have a little doggy. A little white doggy, cutest thing in the world, spoiled to death, as you could imagine, you know. And
he
always gets his ways, and he's a pain in the neck, but he's the cutest little dog. But, you know, he doesn't do anything. He's a good dog, you know. But that's what we do. We do that. We spoil people. You know, I'm going to get off the subject a little bit, and I have no idea whether or not there's any connection here. I was at a meeting. People were talking about, you know, child, you know, rearing children, parenthood, and all this other stuff. And they were philosophizing about it. They're talking about, you know, what people should do or shouldn't do, and whether or not we're prepared to be, you know, parents and all this other stuff. And I thought to myself, I said, no, I think we got this all wrong. I said, we're making too much of this. I said, we should look at pack animals like dogs and wolves. I said, when a baby wolf is born, you know, and it's hanging around, and it starts to grow up, and it weans itself from its mother and the whole bit, and it decides that, you know, the alpha, you know, wolf wants to go east, and he decides, hey, I'm going to go west. There's no talking involved. No one talks. No one preaches. I said, the problem with us as parents is that we talk too much. We constantly preach, but there's no consequence. I'm going to bring this back to what we're talking about, hopefully, okay? And I said, what does the wolf do? Just bites slightly the disobedient wolf, you know, by the neck and goes, no, we're going this way. The wolf knows, okay, sorry about that. Didn't mean it. I just lost my way just for a second, right? And he follows everyone. Now, no words are said, but the wolf set an example saying, you chose me as leader. This is where we're going, and there's no argument. What we tend to do is we talk too much as parents. We scold, but there's no consequence. Now I want to bring this to what we're talking about. It seems like in politics we do the same thing. We talk a lot, right? And there's no damn consequence to anything. It looks like we shed ourselves, we leave our parents, and we adopt our political leaders, and we wind up doing the same thing. We don't do anything for ourselves, right? We wind up just talking about stuff, and there doesn't seem to be any consequence because, don't worry, the politicians will take care of it. I don't know. There's a loose thread somewhere. I mean, there's some sort of connection somewhere, I thought. I don't think there is. But you see my point? We don't seem to take a stance on something and then go through it, and if it's wrong, we suffer the consequences. I have no problem with that. There seems that there can never be a consequence to anything. We try to avoid consequence, avoid blame, and all we do is pronounce everything a success, and we go forward, and everyone's going in a different direction, and then no one knows where they stand.
I agree with you, and you touted a book in one of your earlier shows called, I think it's called The End of America. It's by Naomi Wolf.
Oh, yes, yes.
Very good book. I've had experience kind of skimming that book. I didn't actually read it cover to cover, unfortunately, but I'm familiar with her. I've watched her speak before online on a few different speeches she's given, and I agree with her, but what you're saying is we don't suffer consequences. I would argue that the government doesn't suffer consequences.
That's correct.
For the most part.
Exactly right.
But we will. We definitely will suffer consequences for what they're doing. And in a way, that kind of leans away from socialism into fascism a tad.
That's right.
Not to say that we're a fascist country. I'm not saying that. But you can see a slippery slope develop, you know. And what you're saying about consequence, it's true. We as a people aren't holding our government responsible. And part of that is, I think, we need to make some new constitutional amendments that are overdue. And I'll give two of them because those are really the two that I would push for. And I think they're very important. I think the fact is that our founders were geniuses, okay? They were great men. They were fantastic individuals. And if you're going to argue that anyone in the world was ever touched by a god, it was them, okay?
Right, I agree.
But they were not fortune tellers. They were not psychics.
Right.
They developed this constitution before the Industrial Revolution. They had no idea the Civil War that would erupt. I mean, maybe they had some inkling when they left slavery in under the Constitution, but they never would have foresaw the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
Because of that, we have undue lobbying influence on our government, and it comes mostly in the form of corporate bodies. So the idea that people as a group or as a corporation should somehow be able to legally pay off politicians, and that's what it equates to when they donate to a campaign fund or pay for television time or set up one of these organizations to speak as a mouthpiece for that particular candidate, but not in their name specifically. It's all ways around the rules, and we should just outlaw the monetary supplements that people give to these politicians, lobbying in the sense that it's not just sitting down and giving information to a congressman or senator, should be illegal, in my eyes. Now, people would say, well, then how would you get campaign funds? I would say through the same way we do it now, donations, except it would all go into one fund, and it would be disseminated fairly along with airtime, because in fact, they don't get fair airtime. They don't get fair time to speak. They don't get center stage at the same amount of time. So, I mean, that's one important amendment. And the other, besides separating corporation and state, and by the way, that amendment, that's what I would call it, and if there's people that are already out there with that idea, I'm not the only one. I think somebody even might have wrote a book about it recently, although I have been writing about stuff like that and publishing it with blogs online here and there in different places for quite a few years. So I didn't steal it from anybody, but I would also hope that people would involve in that a separation of corporation and church, because it's undue influence on hurting school systems and parochial schools will then just filter through. They'll just find another route for their undue influence upon our government.
Right. Well,
now the Second Amendment. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go on. I was just going to mention, couldn't we solve some of that problem if we just had term limits for everyone? Everyone serves one term. The House of Representatives, you serve 2 years, so you go back to your job. So we truly have individuals working there. They can take a leave from their job. If they're retired, they can do that for a couple of years and then go back and find themselves a part-time job and live the rest of their lives in misery, whatever they want to do. But at least everyone will serve 2 years. And if they're only going to be there for 2 years, it's not much time for the lobbyists to get in there and to buy you out and to do all this, because by the time they buy you out, you're gone. And they're going to be spending a lot of money on nothing. And I always thought that term limits for everyone, one term only, and I don't subscribe to this argument that, well, geez, how will anything get done? I say, thank heavens, nothing will get done. But if we had everyone with one term limit, you wouldn't have these dynasties and these people controlling the appropriations committees and stuff like that, where they're really running the whole government and everyone's beholden to them. Anyway, my rant on that. Would that term limits help some of that?
I agree with you. Part of my idea is kind of dealing with that, but it doesn't go to specific term limits for one term for an individual. What I thought about that was that guys like that I agree with on certain issues, not to say that they're fantastic, but I don't agree with either one of them completely, but two guys I'll mention, Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul, they're principled, and I don't care if you're agreeing with me all the time. I just want you to be honest.
I agree.
And these guys don't get bought and paid for. There's different websites you can go out there if you really want to look up, and I won't give them now, but you can just go find these websites that find out who your politician is bought off by, and you'll see that these lobbyists don't gravitate to those guys because they're not doing anything for them. They do stuff for you, and that's why they keep getting reelected. So I don't want to deprive people of good elected people, so I wouldn't put term limits like that. What I would say is every 20 years I would be for the an idea I got from reading Thomas Jefferson. He had a quote about wanting a revolution every 20 years, that he thought if the people take up arms every 20 years, that's good for government because it needs to be kept in check.
Right,
so
purging.
He would not advocate, yeah, he would not advocate stopping that. So my idea is to overt that, or get away from that. You don't have to have a violent revolution. You could do it automatically. Every 20 years, the government automatically, all incumbents are not eligible to run for re-election for that next term. Now, if
right.
they want to come back the term after and get re-elected, that's fine.
Right.
But that way we'd have a complete revolution of government every 20 years. And I think what we see a lot with people is that popular opinion wants one thing, and the government's slow to react, because if you look at the age of our representatives compared to the age of the people they're representing, they're oftentimes very much older. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that incumbents are reelected at something like an 80% rate.
Right, yeah, right.
And that's due to funding again. And there's not equal funding to these people, and there should be an equal funding to ideas. If there's any marketplace that should be free market, it should be the marketplace of ideas when it comes to our leadership.
Right. Oh, and Tony, I missed out station identification again because I was so enthralled in what you're listening to you. This is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We have Tony the Brain with us here. We're talking about his paleo conservative viewpoint of things, libertarianism, and a host of other things. Now, we haven't had any call-ins this evening, which I find very disturbing. I know who you are. You better call in. I'm going to come out and get you. All right? Our number is 646-652-4620. 646-652-4620. Please call in with your comments, your questions, and your criticisms. If you disagree, that's fine. We won't get too angry with you. We'd love to hear from you. So please call in. All right. Tony, what about current events right now? Where do you see us going? Where do you see everything, well, everything from the political to, if you want to talk about economics, that's fine. I love to talk about economics. I'm very, very much involved in this whole, I've been studying, you know, what's going on now for over 10 years. I'm so involved in this thing. It's become almost an obsession with me, or a hobby, if you will. But I'll leave it up to you where you want to start, you know, current events.
Well, current events, I guess the economy is, you know, something you almost have to talk about. I don't know what to say about it other than, you know, it's really an unfortunate situation, and I mean, I can't say that I didn't see it coming. My family members and my friends have been hearing me, and sometimes for years have been rolling their eyes at me, but although the eye rolling has stopped now.
Oh, your friends do it to you what they did to me! You're like, oh, here he comes.
Oh,
and like, you know, nutcase. They nod their heads, but I know when I turn around, they go, you know how he is, you know.
Yeah, they definitely have rolled their eyes at me over the years, but they're starting to see that some of the things I've said were correct. Now, every prediction can't be true, but I for years thought the biggest downfall of this country was deficit spending.
Yeah.
And when I was talking about amendments, that was the Second Amendment. I think I'd mentioned that when I called in before one time, is we need an amendment on deficit spending. We need to create a surplus, not operate in deficit.
Right.
And we need to create a reserve. I know that's a foreign term in this country. But
yeah.
We did have a president who paid off a national debt before. This can be done. We don't have to spend ourselves into socialism for the rich or fascism or whatever you want to call it. You know, corporatism is another good name for it. You don't want to, you know, we don't have to do this. There is another route. And look to Jackson, Andrew Jackson, despite any failings any president or any famous person I'll name in history might have, he paid off the national debt. He's the only president to ever pay off a national debt. And he said he was going to get it done, and he got it done. And for once, we had a reserve. We had extra money coming in that wasn't being spent by the government.
Right.
We need to create a reserve, and we need to pay for our own wars every generation, and that would solve a lot of what's going on in today's economy, and it'll happen again if we don't, because there's always going to be a war, and there's always going to be an enemy, and there's always going to be these costs you have to incur, and we don't want to have to print money every time we have one.
Well, in a article by the American Institute of Economic Research, and I wish I had it here. Do I have it here? Oh, I may have it here. Where is it? Yeah, here it is. In fact, I had it from. I was going to discuss this last week. It's and they're very concerned. They just take figures. They don't predict anything. They don't you know, they just say, this is what it is, this is what the published figures are, and they give it out. And they have here a $9 trillion price tag for government bailouts. $9 trillion. Now, we have the unfunded liabilities, and it depends on how you do the accounting, somewhere between $53 and $70 trillion in addition to our national debt. How do we ever get out of this? I mean, even if we went on a program, how do we pay off? I mean, an amount of money that actually is more than the value of the Earth itself. If you want to sell the planet Earth to an alien, they wouldn't give you, you know, $100 trillion. They wouldn't. I mean, it's not worth the hundred. They'd say, hey, you know, I'll give you $20 trillion, and that's about it. You know, forget about it. You know, real estate's not all right. That good. I mean, it's true. I mean, it's not worth it. We are in debt to a point where it's already beyond comprehension. It's beyond paying back. It's beyond, and so it becomes funny money. Something's got to happen as a result of this, Tony. We just can't exist like this. Say, oh, yeah, that'll be $100 trillion, and this will be – eventually something's going to give. Do you have any idea when, what, and what's going to trigger this thing?
I don't know what will trigger the end of the whole calamity, or what I would like to say is be insanity, but – eventually, common sense will prevail among the people, and because of that, their elected leaders, for fear of losing their power, will not, and I don't mean just in re-election, they're going to do something quickly and you know, with haste that makes a little more sense. When you talk about how can we pay this off, before all of this collapse happened back in, I think it was September of 2007, wasn't it? Or 2008.
Yeah, right. It all started about 2007 and slid all the way through. Yeah, 2000. I guess in 2008 it was when it really hit. Let's say the beginning of 2008. That's when Bear Stearns went under. So I think it started in the latter part of 2007.
Okay, so we'll say the latter part of 2007. Yeah, when this all started, I was trying to come up with, you know, because I'm just a nerd, and I just sit around sometimes in my spare time and go through the national budget, fiscal year, you know, 2007, 2008, see the changes, try to devise a way that we could have a better tax system. I'm nobody, and nobody's going to listen to me but you. Thank you, Joe. But nonetheless, that's our answer, is we have to pay it off through tax reform. We've got to change the way we pay taxes and how we look at taxes. Before all this happened, I was devising a plan of my own based on the numbers that were available through the government, and some of them aren't, you know, and for good reason, like the CIA budget's top secret, so you can never really figure out what that is, but
right.
That's good, you know, okay. I can understand that to a certain degree. I mean, I don't agree with everything the CIA does, but I don't want their budget being known by everybody in the world either. But as best as I could figure, it was going to take us, if we totally shifted to some other form of taxation, you know, and minimalized our government to a large degree, it would have taken us 50 years to transition and 50 years to pay it off. But
yeah.
Now, I mean, we're talking, this could be, you know, a century and a half, two centuries. But nonetheless, are we Americans? Are we self-reliant? And are we responsible for this debt? Yes, we are responsible, and we should try to pay it off. We shouldn't just default like everybody's doing right now. Everybody wants bailed out. We as a nation shouldn't want bailed out. We should start getting our house in order. And I mean, not saying anything bad about any companies, but I'm going to say a name of one. We need to tear down the Starbucks and build factories and get back to what made this nation great, which is producing things, not consuming things.
But all of that would require that we have a true free market economy. Where, when I say true free market economy, if we are going to compete overseas, then we have to be competitive. And that means employers, when they have a job that is an unskilled job, and they have someone who has little or no education, no background, no experience, and they want a job, they should be paid commensurate with their non-experience, non-education, whatever. And if that job, if they say, fine, for what you are truly worth, and for what the job is worth in and of itself, you know, we can pay you $2 an hour. Now, until we get to that point, we're never going to be competitive, Because if we have an economy where people come in, and look at General Motors, a classic case, where people who are literally, you know, putting fenders on cars are getting paid $35 and $40 an hour, and that's without burden, you know, the health care and all the other benefits, we can't do that. I mean, it can't happen. It has to be a totally free economy. Now, the way the Europeans see it, Global European Anticipation Bulletin sees us and what's going to happen to us, and unfortunately they've been very correct for years, is they're saying we will default before June of 2009, and when we default, it'll be something like after a weekend or a bank holiday, they'll say, by the way, the dollar is now only worth 10 cents. The new dollars will be worth a dollar, but the old dollars are worth 10 cents. That we are going to devalue our dollars, although it's been devalued 95% anyway already, an additional 90%. And that's the only way we'll be able to pay off our debts. And they said that'll be cataclysmic, not only for the United States, but all over the world. But what they say, by doing that, the United States then will only become from the world's richest country to almost a third world country, where we're working for really coolie wages again. What we produce here would be relatively inexpensive compared to the goods outside the United States, and manufacturing will start rebuilding. Now, isn't that a gruesome sequence of events? But it sort of makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. It's horrible, but it makes sense.
It's realistic. If they continue on the path they're on, and like I told you before, I don't think they will to the extent that all that'll happen, because eventually it'll mean their loss of power, their loss of their job as far as being in the government. So they'll turn tail and head the other way, just like they did on the bailout. Like, everybody's like, oh, the Republican Party standing up against the bailout. No, they stood up against the stimulus. Most of them voted for the bailout, or, you know, enough of them voted for the bailout,
yeah, right.
You know what I mean, to get the thing
right.
Passed. And the first bailout bill that didn't get through was just loaded with a ton of pork for those Republicans that didn't vote for it the first time, so they would the second time. So, you know, I think they're all, you know, ridiculous. But without getting on a rant about that, a lot of the things you're mentioning, in the course of what you're saying, you can solve through tax reform. A lot of it, we have to change our tax. The income tax is a ridiculous idea.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense in the sense that we use it. Now, I'm not saying I wouldn't advocate it in some other sense, but the sense that we use it is ridiculous. It makes no sense. And with your permission, I would like to spend a little time on what my ideas are on tax reform, if that's okay.
Go for it.
Okay. First of all, the first thing that interferes in the free market is the government. So that's why I advocate not paying off politicians with lobbying dollars, because that causes undue influence and always leads to subsidies,
correct.
Corporate welfare, or
right.
farming subsidies, which
right.
again can be looked at as corporate welfare to a certain extent with these large farms we have nowadays, with the huge corporate farms, not so much the small farmer. But this interference is the first and initial. We have to stop that. Once that's stopped, you look at the second undue influence or violence against the market, and that would be tax. And tax in itself does not mean that it has to have that horrible effect on the market. It's the type of tax you use.
Right.
Now, there's a common phenomenon on supply and demand charts known as DWL. That's dead weight loss, and I'll just refer to it as DWL for the rest of this, just to make it easy. That means when you raise the price on something because of a tax that's been put on it, there are less people that can buy it, and there's surplus that's not being bought, and it has effect on how many people are purchasing, therefore the price, the supply, the demand. It just throws everything out of whack.
Correct.
There is one tax in history, one single tax that has no deadweight loss, and I think if we're ever going to talk about free markets, we have to get deadweight loss to its minimum where possible. I'm not saying we can eliminate it completely and eliminate all other taxes completely, but the property tax, and I know people are going to kind of grab their stomachs and retch.
Oh, the libertarians are going to crucify you on that one, yeah.
Oh, I know, but it is an it is the only tax that doesn't interfere in the free market supply and demand, period. It's the only one known to man. And as much as we love property, and believe me, I love property. I live in a rural town. Everybody here is a property owner. I love property, but if you can transfer all your taxation from one thing to another and it doesn't equate to more dollars, does it really make a difference to you where the government's taking it from you?
Yeah, I see your point.
The whole And the whole point of a property tax, to me, is because most people that live in poverty do not own property. And a lot of the problems that I have with the flat tax and the fair tax and all these other tax systems that have been proposed over the years is that they still tax the lower middle class into poverty. Regardless, that is a deadweight loss on our economy. That's less dollars being spent in our economy. That those people are being taxed and then given their dollars back.
Right.
Essentially, they're called working poor people.
Right.
They stay poor because of the tax, but they work full-time just like you and I do and could support themselves if they weren't taxed. And the property tax would get rid of that. Not to mention the fact that when I say property tax, I want everybody in the country to understand that most of the property in this country and the most valuable is owned by corporate entities. It is not owned by the individual landowner. So this is largely going to be carried on the back of corporations, and it might substitute the corporate tax to a large degree. So that I would hope people would take into account with their tums as they're trying to stomach this idea.
But isn't the largest, isn't the largest landholder right now is a property owner? Isn't it the federal government itself?
That's correct, because if you're going to look at private land, it would be true of what I said. But yes, if you're looking at land in totality, both in private and public hands, the government themselves own most of the land. Yeah,
so this would be this would be an incentive for the government to relinquish the property, sell it off, so they can have some taxable income.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Hopefully. Okay. Maybe that'll be a plus towards it.
And property taxes, don't get me wrong, they do have an effect, but it doesn't affect the market in terms of deadweight loss. What it does is it creates an incentive for big business to move into rural areas so that they can take advantage of lower property values, which then raise those property values, and eventually they want to move again.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying that some of this isn't good. Maybe some of this is good, and some of it would be bad. And where it's good and bad, you can have land usage exemptions for corporations and individuals that are, you know, using their property. I advocate that now because I'm majorly for homesteading. I wish they would give us a tax incentive to grow our own food to the degree that we can.
Right.
That frees up money into the economy, acts as a stimulus, and at the same time promotes self-sufficiency, and just as overall would have a great impact on, I think, the free market.
Yeah. The problem that I see is I like to get to the core of the problem, and the core of the problem is that government has gotten so large and so incredibly expensive. We have become an empire, and obviously we're draining ourselves to oblivion. If we would reduce the size of government, that means dismantling the entire empire, just having a minimum amount of an effective a military for self-defense. If we just had if the federal government did what it's supposed to do, and that's just meet once a year to get all the states together to see if we're still in agreement and we're still protecting the rights, the liberties, and freedoms of the individuals, it wouldn't make any difference what we tax, because it would be so insignificant. It wouldn't make any difference if we tax tomato juice, property, sales tax. It wouldn't make any difference because it would just be pennies on the, not pennies, it would be pennies on the $100 relative to what we have now. The problem we have now is that our government is so large, it requires so much income, and it is so far in debt that the tax, you're right, distorts the marketplace. And I say, I like to get further than that, and I like to cut out all the stuff altogether, and so that no matter what we tax, it's insignificant, it won't distort anything.
I agree with you. It'd be the best idea, obviously, is to have no taxes, but I mean,
right.
I don't know if that's achievable, because then that would signify you almost have no government.
Well, when I say no taxes, I mean instead of paying 30%, you're paying 3 or 4%, 5%, you know, and that's
it. No, I agree. Yeah, I agree with that. What you're talking about requires reduction of government, which I'm a big believer in, believe me. We can save a lot of money overseas expenditures, as you said, in the word empire. There's no reason we need to be protecting countries from the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union broke up years and years ago.
Right.
There's no reason that we should still be, you know, protecting the South Vietnamese from the North Vietnamese or whatever, you know, or
right.
North Koreans from South. This is just all ridiculous, you know, and it's expenditures we can't afford. So we could cut back, I think it's estimated some $700 billion. I would say there's about $700 billion that's spent on military expenditure, and there's maybe more than that, depending on how you look at the budget. Some people say up to $1 trillion. You can cut back some 70% of that and still protect our nation and fight terrorism. There's no doubt about that. And I don't, when I say fight terrorism, I don't mean in the sense that we're doing it now.
No, I understand.
Now, also with what you're talking about with reduction of government requires some personal responsibility. And that's right. I talked about the property tax. There's like I said, it's not the only tax I advocate. I advocate an income tax, but I advocate an income tax on people that are of the poorer persuasion, that but not poverty level, like above poverty up to lower middle class level, and it would be regressive as opposed to progressive, and this automatically goes right into a savings account for them to save their own retirement and health expenses to the level that they can.
Yeah.
Now, I know that's not going to completely cover the tab to the full degree that would eliminate all spending like that, but it would decrease it tremendously, maybe by two-thirds, when people are not forced to invest in the stock market, but are, you know, allowed to keep the money in a savings account, or perhaps in gold, silver, something that retains its value, if we're not going to shift our monetary policy away from this ballooning inflation.
Right. Tony, we're going to lose our phone line in about 30 seconds, so we're going to have to sign off. Would you like to tell our listeners where they can maybe sign in on your blog or hear what you have to say?
I really don't have anywhere currently, Joe, but I'll keep in touch with you and see what I can do. Maybe if people want to hear what I have to say, that would be really cool.
Okay, Tony, I'd like to thank you so much. You've been very informative. You're a sharp guy, let me tell you. And I appreciate you being our guest this evening.
Thanks a lot for having me, Joe.
Thank you. Good night now.
Good night.
He was good, folks. He was really good. He was really good. This is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Grant Shaker's Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. That's comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there's no middle ground. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal, the government hates competition." With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned. Oh, by the way, folks, we are going to have Dr. Catherine Albrecht talk to us about real ID, RFID, on Thursday morning. She's an excellent speaker. She's internationally known. And we hope that you'll be listening. That'd be 6:30 Thursday morning. Okay? Until that time, stay well. Stay tuned.